we'll get started right away. Did anybody see Senator Senjum? No, he was in another. Senator Senjum is first up with Senate File 1264.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's good to be here today. Senate File 1264 is a bill which deals with the issue of municipal state aid funding and populations, and in the fact of at least five cities, Byron, La Crescent, Circle Pine, Medina, and Dayton, there were situations going back to the last census where demographically they had these cities in excess of 5,000 in terms of population. As the census then ultimately unfurled, they were less than that, and thus it brings into question some plans that they had, at least the member cities that are sitting here, and I believe the rest of them also, in terms of investments, agreements, and so on, along the lines of road enhancements, and now they have failed the test on the population. And so the idea of this bill is to give them relief, therefore, from that, allow the municipal state aid funding to go forward in view of the fact that demographically they were above 5,000 people prior to the official issue or declaration of the census. So, Mr. Chair and members, I have a couple of people here. Mr. Bill Engerman, the city engineer for Byron and La Crescent, Mary Blair Hoift, city administrator from Byron, and Bill Walter, the city administrator from La Crescent here, and they would appreciate an opportunity to make some comments.
Certainly. Start with Mr. Engerman. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank
Madam
you.
Chair, can I just...
Senator Senjum.
I forgot to do this. Madam Chair, or pardon me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Obviously.
I would like to make a oral amendment on line 125. Making that 2012 instead of 2011. I can't make that amendment. If somebody could do it for me.
Senator Perry offers the Senjum amendment, and if you would again describe that for us, Senator Senjum.
Well, it's making on line 123. I'm sorry. Changing 2011 to 2012 in terms of the effective date.
Heard the amendment. Senator Perry has moved to amend Senate File 1264, line 1.23, to strike the year 2011 and change it to 2012. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Senjum, to the bill.
Chair, I would refer to Mr. Engerman.
Mr. Engerman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill Engerman, as Senator Senjum mentioned, I serve as the city engineer for both Byron and La Crescent, and what we're here today is in support of this bill. Both Byron and La Crescent rely heavily on state aid funding for road construction. For the city of Byron, it is their second largest source of revenue, and for the city of La Crescent, it is their third largest source of revenue. We feel that both cities will be back over 5,000, or actually are over 5,000 population now. We feel that it's very important to our city for our planning, our transportation planning. The halt in funding last year has caused both cities to cancel large construction projects that we would like to initiate again and get back underway. We believe also that our population is real close to 5,000, and in Byron's case, based on our water bills and various things, we actually believe that we never did drop below 5,000, but unfortunately there is not a provision to contest the census. Same thing in La Crescent. We believe that some of the number of vacant houses, things like that, we're actually above that. And obviously our road lengths have not changed. We still manage, pave, and build the same number of streets that we did, whether we're at 5,050 people or 4,950. So we're respectfully asking for passage of this bill.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Ms. Hoift, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, welcome to the committee, if you'd state your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you. Mary Blair Heft, City Administrator of Byron. One of the issues on the census states that we have approximately 95 empty units, rental units and homes. Byron is blessed being located closely to Rochester, and we are not hit by the foreclosure issues. At the time when they did the census, we do agree that there was a 33% vacancy rate in our rental units. But since the time, Byron has continually built houses and grown in population. In 2010, we had 19 homes, and in 2011, we had 22. We currently have 6 building permits right now for spec homes. So Byron is a growing city, and we will continue to be a growing city. We just need to have this opportunity to continue to plan for our streets. As Mr. Angerman mentioned, we did cancel a $2 million street project for 2012 because of the loss of the MSA funds. We were fortunate to get the MSA funds for 1 year. We became over 5,000 in 2009, 2010. We got our first funding in 2011, and then now it's been cut because of the census. So we'd appreciate the opportunity that you would consider this and allow us to have either a stepping stone, you know, of so many years, or to be able to maintain our MSA funds. We get approximately $170,000, and as Mr. Angerman noted, that is our second highest funding source.
Ms. Hutt, could you talk a little bit more about, now you've kind of thrown a curveball at me, because in my original thinking we were talking about census data and census figures. Now you said that in 2009 you went above 5,000, you
correct,
became eligible for 1 year.
Each year cities get an estimate from the state demographer, and that's what all of our like our LGA is based off of, and HSA, that's what our funding is based off of, is the state demographer's estimate. So in April of each year we get an estimate of, you know, of the population. And the state demographer had us at 5,054 for 2009. We get it a year later. So in 2010, we're notified that in 2009, we had a population of 5,054. And then in 2011, when the census data came out, right when you turn 5,000, they get geared up at MnDOT to allocate out our funding. We got our funding, and then the census came out and said, Byron is really 4,900. And 15, or, you know, we're short like 80 people. Mm-hmm. But the biggest hitter was that we had like 95 empty units. That would be both houses and rentals.
Okay. Well, thanks for that clarification. I didn't understand, I guess, that the demographer comes into this picture at
right
all.
Now we
so
have
that's an annual estimate that the demographer does. And okay.
Well, yep.
That's interesting. So potentially, if the demographer does another evaluation of Byron this year, your population most likely will be back up over 5,000, according to what you're saying, and then those funds will be reinstated.
Well, from what I understand, because I haven't been through a period of census, but in 2011, they used the 2010 census figure. That's what the demographer will go off of. And now he'll recalculate based each year on the number of building permits. Yes, Byron does expect to go through that. However, I've been informed that they're very cautious. The state demographer becomes very cautious after census. And so we will have to prove our vacancy rate, because at the time we had a 33% vacancy rate. We did some, you know, checking back with our major renters. And then we can look at our water bills to see how many houses are sitting empty. As of April of 2011, we had a 1% vacancy rate. So it'll be our job to prove to them that we truly have this. The unfortunate thing is, by the time we prove it to them, we might have lost out on a couple years of MSA.
Okay.
And I think that's pretty much everybody's right on a ledge, you know, a couple hundred people. You slip back and forth based on people moving in and out.
Senator Perry?
She just answered my question. Thank you.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, and perhaps staff can help with this also. So for the purposes of the state aid funding, is this based on census data or is this based on demographer data? In other words, is this done once every 10 years and then that standard applies for 10 years, or is this done annually tying into what the census says, but going forward, evaluating this on a yearly basis?
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lilly, I think I'm going to, my understanding based on everything I know about this, it's based on demographers' data, as it was for
Correct.
You as you got your first payment, but I think that it might be better for Senate Counsel to offer the expert opinion.
The real expert, I understand, is here in the audience. Rick Jonas. Why don't we have him step up and just enlighten the committee on how this works?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a yearly state demographer's estimate, and that is what we use. We get a new number every June.
That comes out in June. Okay. Senator Lilly?
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jonas, so in the scenario that is in front of us, Byron is now below the number, so they do not have access to the state highway funds, correct? So next year, given the data that's been presented, they are over that number. Would they then qualify for the funds again the following year? Or is there a waiting period? Or how does this work?
Mr. Jonas?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Lilly. My name is Rick Jonas, but for the record, Deputy State Aid Engineer. If the state demographer's number in June puts the city back up over 5,000, we will be able to reinstate them for the 2013 apportionment next January. Given that they're in that situation, both the city and our office have taken a go-slow approach to removing all the designations of state aid streets within their community and having the county assume some of the responsibilities. It's made sense to us to take a kind of a go-slow approach on this, thinking that the city will eventually be back over 5,000. So we're prepared to reinstate them when the time comes.
Okay, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So according to our testifiers, the challenge and the data that we now have, the challenge is that you cannot plan. You cannot effectively budget and plan for your expenses, your development. If you're planning a $2 million project, you've had to cancel that project because you don't know if the funds will be there or will not. They probably will not. So rather than going forward with a project that, in all likelihood, next year you will be able to complete because you will meet the numbers again, you've had to put that on hold and wait. So really the challenge that you're facing in your situation is that you're on this bubble of 5,000 above and below it, and because of that it's caused instability in decision-making and you can't plan. Would that be correct?
Correct. And I'll just go one step further. Because of our size, we only have so many state aid roads. So we do have a bad road at this portion. If we would go ahead and do it and get the state aid later, we can't then allocate the state aid to that road after the fact. Does that make sense?
Senator Lilly, yes.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, might we consider separating the issues? We have two different types of communities, I believe. One community is one that is constantly above or below and cannot plan. We may have other communities that drop below 5,000 and remain below 5,000, and the prospects of them getting back up to 5,000 maybe many years or decades or may not happen in the future. So might I recommend that we consider wording that would offer a one-year extension or some period of an extension on the process and then would sunset the process for cities that do not. And I think the benefit of considering that language would be that cities such as Byron, La Crescent, and Circle Pines and the others would be able to plan much more effectively as they are going up and up and below that line. However, the purpose of the state aid funding is that it is to apply to cities over 5,000, and we would be true to that that structure.
That constitutional provision that that we would be circumventing in the event that we would make this exception. Senator Perry, did you have something?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't know if we can have Mr. Jonas come back. I've got a quick question for him. While you're coming up, I'll shoot the question out. Is there an average of those communities that slip below and above, back and forth? Is there an average to the amount that they drop below? Is it 25, 100, 200?
Mr. Jonas?
Chair, members of the committee, during the last 5 or 6 years, the number of cities has actually been going up one or two per year based on the state demographer and Metropolitan Council's estimates. So we've climbed from 133 to currently 142. We were at 147, and then the census dropped five cities off. Some of the cities dropped to 4,950, so they're just 50 short. A few cities dropped 300 or 400, and they're probably on the decline.
Follow-up.
Senator Perry.
Just to clarify a little bit more, I'm specifically talking about population. If there's an average below and above that, you know, if we're talking like Senator Lilly has suggested, an average, if there was an average, it would make it easy. You know, if, for an example, the average was 150 population, so the 5,000 drops to, you know, 48.5, then maybe you could set those parameters they have 2 or 3 years. I think that's what I'm hearing Senator Lilly say, if they maintain that and drop below that, then they're completely out. But if they float in there, you just keep them going until. Is that kind of where we're going, Senator Lilly? I'm trying to get a handle on what you were asking and where you were going, if that's what you were looking for.
Well, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, actually, could we turn to council for some direction on how this might work, this concept?
Ms. Berzovsky?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lilly, it would be possible to sunset this provision so that it would apply for as long as you would want it to apply for, and then it would go away. So, you know, the city then it had been 5,000 before the census. It dropped below. It's deemed to be 5,000 for X number of years following the census. And then the language goes away. That's what you want to do.
Mr. Chair.
You see where we're headed, Senator Sanjom?
Mr. Chair, it seems to me we're trying to build a bridge here that might work. And I think, and I will, there may be people from Circle Pines, Medina, and Dayton in the audience. I'm not sure.
It's for 10 years.
I would tell you, for standpoint of Byron and La Crescent, I mean, they're next to La Crosse and Rochester, and those are population centers that are growing. And I don't think you're going to see any drop back here. I will virtually almost guarantee it. Both of these centers are moving forward. I can't say with that assuredness about the other three, but you know, that's a metropolitan area, and I would believe there's, you know, going to be growth.
Senator Howe, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair. I've got a question. Maybe I don't know if Mr. Jonas is the right person to answer it, but I was just wanted to ask, when was this put into our Constitution, and does it fit within the rationale that the reason why we put the 5,000 limits there, and does it make sense anymore? I mean, is it simply a funding issue, or what happens with that $2 million if it's not allocated to you? Does that reallocated to other people? And is the limit there because of a funding issue, or is it Has things changed in the last 50 or 60 years from when this was put in the Constitution? Anybody want to take that question?
Mr. Jonas? It's getting to be aerobic for you here, but I appreciate you coming back up and visiting this question.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Jonas.
Again, for the record, my name is Rick Jonas, Deputy State Engineer of MnDOT. The Constitution is where the 5,000 number is. It's been there since since the Constitution. We've had every census, we've had issues like this. In 1990, I think there was three or four cities that fell below 5,000, and the legislature at that time stepped in and provided an opportunity for the cities to have a three-year phase-out after that census. And there was an issue after the 2000 census also that was dealt with. So I do understand the difficulty of a city losing their money on short notice. I understand that. But the number 5,000 is in the Constitution.
But
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is, what's the rationale for that number? If it was done so many years ago, has things changed? I mean, is 5,000 still a good number? I mean, are there issues, are there communities that are 3,000 or 2,500 or 4,000 that are, you know, do you have to grow so big before you become eligible for the rationale of these funds? And is that hold true today? I mean, is that what we want to do, or is it just simply a case of how we manage our funds? And then if it is, well, here's 5,000, you know, take it or leave it, you've got to be at a population of 5,000, those funds are redistributed, or are we holding this $2 million for this community? How does that work?
Mr. Jonas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Howell, the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, the gas taxes and the motor vehicle taxes and everything that comes together, is distributed 62% to MnDOT, 29% to counties, 9% to cities. Cities is the area that has been showing the most growth. There are, as testified earlier, 142 cities right now over 5,000 population. If we go back 20 years, there would have been 120, 115 cities at that time. Additionally, each city is growing, and they get state aid money based on 20% of the urban miles within their corporate limits. There are 3,300 miles of municipal state aid street in the state right now. 10 years ago when I started with MnDOT, there was approximately 2,700 miles. The amount of money that the cities receive for that fund to distribute throughout those cities and those mileages hasn't really changed a whole lot, being 9% of the pot. I mean, there was the spike in 2008 when some of the increases were put in place, but the dilution of adding more cities and more mileage each year has taken a toll on how much each city and each mile is earning out of that fund, which currently sits at about $110 million per year.
Very interesting. Thank you, Mr. Jonas. Before you get up, any other questions for Mr. Jonas? Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that I think this leads into a bigger question, and that we may have to examine this a little bit further than just accommodating a couple cities every time there's a census. That's my point.
Thank you, Senator Hall. I think you're on the same track that the rest of the committee is, that we currently have, I understand, an exemption for one town that, you know, whether it should be in there or not at this point in time is a question, but we need to address this. It sounds like it was addressed in 2001, 2002, because we had a similar situation. I imagine every 10 years we're going to have to be dealing with this. Senator Dibble, do you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Senator Howe that it's worth examining the original rationale in the Constitution for the $5,000. I'm not sure I'm into pursuing a constitutional amendment this year.
You wouldn't use those words.
But it's definitely worth understanding why that was put in place back in statehood days. Senator Rust can maybe help us out with a little history. You're the statehood champion. So, but to your point that you just made, I'd be really interested in just establishing a policy that deals with this, so I don't have to create a little exceptional language every 10 years. You know, maybe a standing phasing for cities that drop a little bit below, maybe involving the state demographer. You know, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to this idea of, you know, this problem that's created if we just cut folks off and they've got a $2 million project waiting to go and they have to completely cancel it. That's not fair, and that just wreaks havoc on cities and their planning. And then should they, you know, kind of ramp back up to above 5,000, you know, in the state demographer can project that that's likely to happen or that has happened, then we just get them right back in, and so we're not yanking cities around. We can just establish a standing policy that deals with that issue.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens if a city, and I was at a legislative audit commission meeting, so I'm sorry I'm late. What happens if a city, okay, gets down to 4,800 now and stays there, but we treat it as if it has 5,000, and now and then 10 years from now, maybe it's at 4,500, and we're still going to be treating it, I mean, and they make a project, and then we'll still treat it as a city of 5,000. What's the point of having a designated population limit to getting the state aid, and is that fair to the other cities? If a city keeps losing population, but it's treated as if it didn't. I mean, you talk about fairness in setting up a project, but what about the other cities?
Well,
Senator Dibble.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I think that those are the points that Senator Lilly brought up earlier. You know, dealing with these situations, which are different than what you described, a small population change that likely is to be reversed. Versus what this language would do, which is exactly what you described, which would, if a city, you know, does lose population forever, yeah, then but they would forever be in the MSA system, and so this language probably wouldn't work out so well. So something different that would get us to an in-between point, which sounds like Senator Senjum is open to working on.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, so having an individual case-by-case exemption, that's not the best way to do law, but in this instance, I'd be very uncomfortable with having just a blanket waiver myself.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Senjum.
I mean, just a comment. We may be all talking about the same thing, but it would just seem to me if we, I don't know, a couple of year on ramp, maybe a couple of years off ramp, so to speak. We use the word ramp around here a lot, but just so it's not so abrupt. There may be some cities that obviously are declining in population, and that may not stop real quickly. And yet there are cities on the bubble like these that, you know, but for perhaps the recession. And I think the city administrator from Byron indicated that a number of those apartments now are all filled up that weren't filled during the recession or during the census. So. So it's a bubble situation, but I think there's every indication that going forward, at least with these cities, we're gonna be on the positive side of 5,000.
Senator Scher?
Well, we're probably all saying the same thing and beating a bush, but I really appreciate Senator Lilly's question. There's other times that we've put this 5,000 cities of 5,000 would not get the local government aid cuts or would get them or something, and then the census number, there's this variation right around that number 5,000, so they're at 4,999, and now there's that cut, you know. So I thought about a model that would do a margin of error, you know, that you have to apply a margin of error in statistics, you know, that are applied. Something maybe further to talk about how to address this, but I agree that I also like the question about what's the rationale anymore about 5,000? Simply because a city's under the size of 5,000, why does that mean they don't need state aid on a road that may have local and state importance to it. You know, that's your question, I think, Senator Howe is asking. What's this 5,000 number, and does that make sense anymore? What's its history and what's its rationale? So I'm unclear about that as well.
Looks like Mr. Jonas might be able to enlighten us a little bit.
Mr. Chair, yes, I would like to add to that question, and Senator, that 50 years ago when the state aid system was put into place, I've heard it said that a city of 5,000 population often would have work and sufficient tax base to warrant a full-time city engineer. And that might have been the thinking in the 1950s when they put this all together. What happens to cities that are under 5,000, there still often, usually, are state aid roads in that community, but they're under the oversight of the county engineer. Once a city reaches 5,000 population, then the county engineer steps out of it. But for the 500 or 600 cities in Minnesota that are under 5,000 population, the county engineer will designate those community interest routes that should be on the state aid system, collects an urban money and needs to spend the money, that portion of the county's allotment, in those cities under 5,000 in their county and serve on behalf of the city.
Well, I think we are, to some degree, rehashing the territory that we have covered here, just to some degree, very good information and testimony on this. We still have a testifier. Mr. Walter, you haven't had an opportunity to speak to this bill.
Welcome
to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Waller. I'm the city administrator for the city of La Crescent. I would agree that you've heard most of probably what I'm going to would have to say, so I'll cut my comments short if that's okay and answer any questions that you may have. For the city of La Crescent, this is our third largest revenue source. It's approximately 10% of our total revenue that we take in. It's about $214,000 a year to La Crescent, which is significant. We postponed a major street project in 2011. And we are continuing to grow. In 2010 to 2011, we've annexed 26 new homes into the community, extended water and sewer to them, and we're building between 6 and 8 new houses a year. And the challenge for us is that if the funding stops at the start of 2012, there is no time for cities like Byron, La Crescent, to work through the process either with the federal people or the state people on trying to revise those numbers. So, you know, a 2 or 3 year window for us to work through the process is certainly something that would be agreeable or workable.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. And I think that you sense the direction that we're headed here, Senator Senjum. Senator Howe?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Senjum, I'm wondering if you would take this as a friendly amendment to it, just at the 1.22, if we would just add for a period of 2 years.
Mr. Chair, could I?
Senator Lilly?
Could I offer a friendly addition to that?
Sure.
If we said for 2 fiscal years, because we want to make sure, is it when the census comes out? Is it the fiscal year? What does the two years denote?
Definition.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, would Senator Senjum, would that work for you to put on 2 fiscal years?
That look all right?
Mr. Chairman, the city's fiscal year is a calendar year.
Right. Calendar year.
It's not like the state.
Yeah, it's just their fiscal year.
No, it's a calendar year.
Not sure where the conversation is here, if it's within the committee or if it's across the table. But
it seems like, you know, the essence of this is fine, and we do get into the whether it's a state fiscal year or cities, which typically operate on a calendar year.
Right. So,
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I think if we just add for a period of 2 years, we'll let the powers of be decide what those 2 years are. I mean, I think it'll come down to the funding on it, and the MnDOT will make that decision, correct?
Senator Senjum, I think we'll hear from Senate Council. They need to offer us some clarity as far as what we will need in this discussion.
Mr. Chair and members, my suggestion would be to repeal the language as of a date certain, and it could be June 30, 2014. That would be 2 years following the effective date of this language. And that way there would be no uncertainty, no depending on budgets. And you might notice on 122, this language is limited to the 2010 federal census. This isn't something that this bill contemplates doing every decade. So to just repeal the language, I think, would maybe just be cleaner. It wouldn't keep this language on the books, and everyone would know how long that aid would be available.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. At the risk of confusing the issue a little bit, the presence of the 2010 federal census means that even with the, you know, the time limited, does not get us then to a, you know, doesn't, then that means a future legislature 10 years from now may have to solve this problem again. And so it doesn't get to kind of a, you know, the kind of larger ongoing solution, you know, that will no doubt occur again after the 2020 census.
Right.
So I was wondering if we could do something that says after, according to the most recent federal census, is deemed to have a population of 5,000 for purposes of this chapter for a period of time. That's what I was hoping we could get to.
The permanent solution.
Create a more permanent idea. I mean, we don't have to, but
yeah, no,
we don't have to do the work of a future legislature, I guess, but it'd be nice.
Senator Gimsey.
I appreciate the input there. I think that this, where we're headed here and in the essence of time that we have on this bill, I think it does need some work. And, you know, I think you get a clear sense of where the committee wants to be and where we want to go with this. We want to be helpful. Phase out over a period of time type of thing. Are you amenable at all to laying this bill over, Senator Senjum?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I think we should. We need to get this language right, and if I could come back at some point with an amendment or a new bill, whatever the case might be, appreciate the discussion today because I think it's been good, but I think this can be resolved with some time.
Thank you, Senator Senjum, and I think that probably is the appropriate course. We don't want to do this type of work in an hour and a half committee hearing when we have other bills that we would like to hear. There's a ways to go, but we can get there, and we will rehear the bill and sure. when it's cleaned up. So, Senator Howe, do you have a motion?
Yes, I do. I move that Senate File 1264 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Senator Howe has moved that this bill be held over for possible inclusion in the second omnibus policy bill.
As amended.
We want to rehear it, though.
That's
not the right word. Then we don't want to move it.
Just lay it over.
Just lay it over.
Yeah, lay it over. Yeah.
Senator Howe moves that we lay Senate File 1264 over. Period. Thank you, Senator Rest. All those in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And
thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up is Senator Ortman with Senate File 1687. I think I can hear Senator Ortman's voice coming in. We'll give her a moment, and hopefully she'll be here.
Bill.
Senator Dibble, are you teed up?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Let's take your bell. Unless. Very good.
Hello.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and members, it's good to be back in the Transportation Committee. It's been a while. The bill we have today, Senate 1687, is a bill that's been heard here in the legislature before. I believe this committee has passed it before. It's the kind of bill, because of its nature, it will get many hearings. And so this is the first stop for this bill. It will definitely, if it passes through this committee, go to Commerce for their review, and also the Judiciary Committee. So we've got some time to work on this if folks have questions. But let me tell you generally what the concept here is. Minnesota truckers have had some challenges in our marketplace because of a request on the part of their contract partners that they indemnify the folks that are actually contracting with them to transport their products. And so what this bill would do is say that it is against public policy in Minnesota for these contracts to include indemnification language. The purpose here would be then to make sure that all of the parties to these contracts bear responsibility for their own conduct and their own actions. And so that if there is some accident, if there is some breach of contract, then each of the parties in the relationship would bear their own responsibility in a court of law if there were any kind of suit that followed. So that's the basic premise. All parties should bear their own responsibility for their own conduct in the transaction. This would also make sure that third parties that are involved would also bear full responsibility for their own conduct. So, members, that's the nature of the bill. I have with me some very distinguished folks here who will testify in favor of this bill. First is John Hosladen from the Truckers Association, who's going to talk a little bit about the trucking industry. And then we have some practitioners here, the president of that association and one of her colleagues as well, who will all explain a little bit about how the current law has been impacting their ability to do business in Minnesota.
Mr. Hosladen, welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is John Hosladen. I am president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. We are a statewide trucking association representing 700 member carriers and their vendors. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate File 1687. The MTA has brought forth this legislation really out of requests from our smaller members. And when you take a look at the scope, there are about 32,000, almost 33,000 trucking companies in the state that have interstate authority that would be affected by this. And I think one fact that is often missed, and this statistic just blows people away, 97.1% of carriers in the country operate 20 or fewer trucks. This industry is still largely a small truck type operation, a lot of what we call mom-pop operations where they own it, they run it, they live it, they breathe it. And so these are the kind of folks that we're here to talk about today and to represent. We are not charting new territory here, but we are learning from the lessons of others. You should have a packet in front of you, and you'll see a map that there are 30 other states that have adopted this language, which is very similar. And as been noted, I have with me today Joyce Brenny, our chairwoman of the organization, and Mel Simon. If it pleases the chair, we'll tag team. So Ms. Brenny will explain why this bill is important to trucking companies like hers, and then Mr. Simon will describe how these clauses play out in real life.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hosladen. Mr. Simon, Ms. Brenny, whoever would like to start first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Joyce Brenny, and I am the chairwoman of the Minnesota Trucking Association and the president and owner of Brenny Specialized Transportation in St. Joseph. We are an interstate carrier, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 1687. Truckers must comply with state and federal regulations as they transport goods. We also have contracts with shippers that spell out additional legal duties and responsibilities. Many of the provisions are important and beneficial. However, a growing number of large shippers are holding having us hold harmless one-way indemnification clauses to freight hauling contracts. These clauses require trucking companies to hold shippers harmless for the shipper's own negligence and inattentional acts or omissions. These kinds of indemnification clauses present two significant problems. First, they unfairly shift liability to one party. If truckers sign the contract, they accept nearly all the risk in the relationship, including the risk for events and actions that might be out of their control. Some would say, just don't sign the contract. The reality is we can't afford to. Trucking firms, particularly small ones, feel that if they balk at these provisions, they will lose business. Trust me, in today's freight markets, we can't afford to not sign these contracts. Smaller truckers simply have no leverage to negotiate these clauses out of the contract, and sometimes we even lose business to other states if we do not sign these contracts. The second problem is these clauses reduce the incentive for shippers to act safely. One of the fundamental reasons why we assign liability is to persuade people to regulate their own behavior. Taking that out of the equation creates a risk to public safety. In this example that you were given in the contract, an actual contract, the shipper required that the trucker indemnify them for not only their partial negligence, but also their sole negligence, as well as any actions which they would typically be held strictly liable. Often missed in this discussion are the back-end ramifications. Most truckers carry a high deductible to keep premiums down. Those are the first dollars paid out if a shipper's negligence causes a catastrophic bodily injury. The trucker is also looking at years of additional costs, liability insurance raise, and we might be dealing with higher workman's comp issues as well. Let's be clear about what this legislation actually does. It would make void any provisions in a motor carrier contract that sought to indemnify a promisee, a shipper, for its own negligence and intentional acts or omissions leading to legal claims. It would also preserve the incentive for shippers involved in motor carrier contracts to perform their obligations and duties safely. On the other hand, this bill would not establish any new legal duties or responsibilities for either party. It would not void entire contracts, just the offending provisions I've described. In conclusion, this bill simply assigns responsibility where it rightfully belongs, and it improves safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brenny. Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mel Simon. I'm president of Steyer Transportation. We're a 70-truck motor carrier based in Lakeville, Minnesota. And I, as well, am here to testify in support of Senate File 1687. I know about these clauses because our company ended up on the wrong end of such a deal. In 2004, a Steyer trailer was dropped at one of our shippers' facilities. They loaded the pallets and then placed those pallets on our trailer. Once it was full, the trailer was shut and sealed. Unknown to us, one of the pallets that they used was defective. Our driver hooked up to the trailer, began to make his deliveries. At one stop, the receiver refused to enter the trailer to pull the loaded pallets off. So our driver proceeded to remove the pallets with a hand pallet jack. When he began to move the pallet that was defective, the 1,500-pound load on that pallet shifted and he wrenched his back. He had extensive medical treatment following that. The driver brought suit against the shipper, which settled the claim for $40,000. However, because of the hold harmless clause in the contract, the shipper had no obligation to pay the settlement. We were the ones on the hook for the $40,000. So we, Steyer Transportation, paid directly $15,000 of it, which was our deductible on our policy. Our insurance company paid the remaining $25,000. And then, as you can guess, our insurance rates were adjusted after the fact to reflect that. In short, in this situation, the driver ended up suing us. I have no problem being responsible for our own acts and our own negligence. However, I do have a big problem being responsible for other people's negligence. So I urge you to pass Senate File 1687.
Well, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, one final comment about this. This is why it makes sense to declare a public policy in the state of Minnesota, because there's a terrible disincentive here for the person being indemnified. It's really unusual to require someone to insure the acts of others. And that's what's happening here because of the marketplace that we have right now. These shippers are requiring trucking companies to indemnify them and essentially insure against the acts of their employees and agents and servants. So it's unusual, a request to declare a public policy here, but I think that it makes sense under these circumstances.
Senator Hall?
I've got a couple questions, Mr. Chair. Two questions. One is, does this indemnify, would this change anything between brokers and individual owner-operators? I mean, is it the same thing where an owner-operator indemnifies a broker? Would this would that address that issue too, or is that not addressed in this bill?
Senator Ortman?
It doesn't address it.
I don't believe
it doesn't address that issue. The second question is what would this do on a national level with the truck drivers? And my question is if you have a national firm, let's say, that is doing a contract with a shipper in Minnesota, knowing that this is the law in Minnesota, how would this address or how would this apply to a national trucking firm who's got a contract with somebody that's, say, headquartered out of Chicago, Illinois, but is delivering to several stores or retail locations in Minnesota? They sign, you know, the standard boilerplate contract outside of Minnesota. They're based outside of Minnesota, but they're doing business in Minnesota. And my concern, the reason for my question is, would this apply to that contract if it's, you know, they're based outside, the shipper is based outside, but they're delivering here? And my concern is, does that put us, the trucking firms, at a disadvantage for getting national contracts?
Senator Ortman?
I was going to say, if I hear you correctly, Senator Howe, what you're asking about is the first, second, and third-party contracts. And my understanding from this bill is that each of the parties in that line would be responsible for their own conduct. So the first party, the second party, and the third party.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, my question is but if somebody signed, you know, in Minnesota, this is saying that's null and void, you know, that regardless of whether it's signed or not. My question is, would this apply, would this statute apply to a contract that is executed outside of our state, performed by a organization that's out of our state, but yet doing business in our state? How would the courts view this in saying that, well, Your Honor, you know, we're outside of the state, we've got this contract, and they're coming in and doing this delivery? And that's my question, is how would this be applied in a judicial setting?
Mr. Houselaud?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Howe. Basically, when you sign a contract, typically you'll have a venue that you agree upon where disputes will be settled. So if it was an Illinois carrier and that was in the contract, that's where it would be settled, which is one of the reasons we're trying to do this in Minnesota. As I've said, we have 30 states already. It's our goal as an industry to, you know, basically get all the states to do it, so then that becomes a moot point.
Thank you. Anybody in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? Seeing none. Do we have a motion? Senator Howe, do you have a motion?
I'll try it again.
I'll try to be helpful again.
I'll move that Senate File 1687 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Commerce.
Senator Hall has moved the Senate File 1687 be recommended to pass and move to the Committee on Commerce. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Members, thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is Senator Dibble. Thank you.
Chair. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have before us Senate file. What Senate file is this? Senate file 1126 that has to do with highway construction projects and contractor bid preferences modifications. And, Mr. Chair, I have an amendment.
All right.
And actually, I don't.
Do we have the amendment out?
I don't think it's coming, I guess. I believe it's the A1 amendment. Probably need a copy of it myself, Mr. Chair. I only had it emailed to me.
Everybody got a copy of that? Yeah.
May I have a copy?
Senator Dibble, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment is not the lead-all amendment. It's a line and page amendment. I'll move the A1, and then I'll present the bill from there.
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment. Do you want to explain it? Or do you want it adopted first?
I thought I'd adopt it, and then okay. It's a substantive change to the bill. And
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment to be adopted to Senate File 1126. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? It's adopted to your amendment.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I should have mentioned, and I'll mention now, that this brings then the A1 amendment brings our Senate file into conformance with an agreement that had been arrived at in the House. Not that we follow what the House does. We have the Senate. But,
All right, thank you.
It is an agreement that was achieved between the stakeholders and the agency and the House members. So it's I reviewed it and I support it. Mr. Chair and members, the goal of Senate File 1126 is to develop a targeted group business program so that we can be sure that owners of businesses of smaller businesses in our community are able to compete on a level playing field for business that is made available through the development and construction of our transportation infrastructure throughout the state. It is responsive to findings that were commissioned by the legislature and a study that was carried out by the Department of Administration with an independent objective third party, that there continue to be significant disparities in who actually enjoys the benefit of contracts that are let, particularly small businesses that are minority-owned in the state of Minnesota. It's hard to really say exactly why that occurs with a tremendous amount of precision, and, of course, we don't want to cast aspersion on any individual or any class of businesses or a group of people. I think it is fair to say that much of what folks experience yet today in our state is a legacy of past discrimination, and this is an attempt simply to address that. The findings were strong and very, very clear. This is the outgrowth of work that has been carried out at MnDOT among a large number of stakeholders from industry, from the community, from agencies, across the professional spectrum. It's a work called that's referred to as the collaborative, and this is one of the recommendations of many that have come forward. Mr. Tittle from MnDOT will explain in a little more detail some of that work and then some of the particulars about what we propose to accomplish with this bill. As to the bill itself, what we did remove were some findings. We don't like findings necessarily as a matter of course in statute in our bills, and so we tend to remove them. But these findings were fairly important because they establish a level of intent that would be pretty important to carry forward. Those findings in the original bill, you can see starting at the bottom of page 1, subdivision 1A, legislative findings, the legislature find as follows. And I thought I would just, with the indulgence of the committee, read them so that my intent in passing this bill is clear. If at some point in the future it's important to have that in the record, I might also do the same on the floor. It says, at the time of these findings, businesses that are operated and majority owned by non-minority women, by persons with any substantial physical disability, or by members of a specific minority group are underutilized in Minnesota highway construction contracts. At the time of these findings, evidence demonstrates that race-neutral measures are ineffective to correct the impact of past discrimination that exists in highway construction and must be supplemented with race and gender-conscious measures. And the state has a compelling interest to remedy the effects of past or present discrimination in the Minnesota highway construction industry through the implementation of a targeted group business program that meets state and federal constitutional guidelines. And that simply reflects the research and the report that was turned in by the Department of Administration last year. The bill itself sets forth commissioner himself has the authorization to set a 4% preference for specific construction work. It asks the prime contractors, it allows the commissioner to develop goals for subcontracting with minority subcontractors. It provides for a periodic reevaluation of this program to do similar work that had been done that established these findings to make sure that this is still something that's necessary or not. It limits the eligibility for a specific targeted group business to 8 years. That was one of the compromises, removing the findings, then this language limiting the eligibility, the time period for a specific business to be eligible for participation in this program to 8 years. And then it requests a report to the legislature to make sure that we're on top of things, we're receiving periodic reports, how effective and how well this particular effort is being implemented. And finally, the last part, and I'll ask council maybe to help me, it make some adjustments to a working capital fund that's been established for assisting these small targeted group businesses. Some language changes. There's a change in a federal citation. I think that might be some technical language changes to this working capital fund program. Mr. Chair, I would I'd like to ask Mr. Tittle to provide his testimony now.
Mr. Tittle.
Yes. It's Alex Tittle. For the record, Department of Transportation, Office of Civil Rights, I'm the Deputy Director for the office. Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill. The purpose of these amendments are to clarify areas within the legislation that might prove problematic within the administration of this program. In my role as the Deputy Director, I would be responsible for administering the program through a staff that would be hired to do so. MnDOT has also received an order or the director from the Department of Administration back in April 2010 from them to address the disparities within this disparity study that Senator Dibble just recalled, which was conducted in 2009, of small business owners within Minnesota. And the areas that were identified of recognizing disparity were amongst ethnic minorities, women, and people with disabilities. MnDOT has also recognized a few areas that are addressed in the legislation that will streamline the program. Number one, as Senator Dibble mentioned, I'll briefly go through, but Subdivision 4A reflects a sunset provision in Minnesota Statute 16C that recognizes that as a remediation program used to guide each participant to a successful end. So it doesn't just linger on, and we don't see any results at the end of a season or two. This area requires the Department of Administration also to periodically reassess through reports that Senator Dibble also mentioned. And also, I want to mention how else we recognize reports is through the collaborative. The collaborative was established back in 2008 through a number of stakeholders, of which I was a member of prior to my employment with MnDOT a little less than 5 months ago. The collaborative consists of 8 different working stakeholder groups, one of which is the prime contractors. Others are representative are disadvantaged businesses, community members, social action groups, associations like the AGC or Association of General Contractors, National Association of Minority Contractors, Association of Women Contractors, and the like. So there's a large representation that regularly participates in this effort on a monthly basis to address a lot of these issues, to include this one, that representative of the TGB or the targeted group businesses, as well as the veterans groups. also inclusive in these key stakeholders are the actual TGBs that are clearly affected by this legislation. So I wanted to mention that they are active participants in this effort. The key factor here is maintaining efficiency, streamlining process, and minimizing the administrative work required by our primary contractors. All being said, we appreciate your support with this important legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all might have.
Any questions for Mr. Tittle or Senator Dibble? Senator DeGraff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tittle, I have a question. Is there a fiscal note from MnDOT with this or this bill or not?
Senator Dibble? Or Mr. Tittle?
Excuse me?
Nope. Mr. Chair,
I'll defer.
I have not seen a fiscal note. I don't know if one is in the works.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, there was a fiscal note on the introduced version of the bill that was not quite complete by the time of committee. Okay. It was a zero fiscal impact, and I believe that was mainly because the amount was appropriated for the targeted group business program in the last budget bill. So that would be absorbed within that $130,000 a year. I understand that there will be a slight impact when it comes to the amendment because of the reporting requirements, but I don't have a number for that.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we've gotten into a discussion like this before, and I'm going to bring it up again because, you know, in the findings, I see what you had here on the original Senator Dibble, but it bothers me when I don't see any qualification to the words underutilized, past discrimination, past or present discrimination. I mean, if there's proof of that, it would be nice to know what that is and what qualifies for past discrimination. But most importantly to me is, are we trying to build new businesses here? Are these businesses actually qualified to perform the contracts that are out there? Or I think we've had this discussion. I'm trying to bring it back because it's not we as the government, are we trying to build minority businesses or veteran businesses through this program, or are these actual businesses that could qualify for a contract but are not big enough to handle the whole contract? Is that Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Senator Perry, excellent questions, all of which it's a range of issues that you touch on, all of which, and it's a complicated issue. It's an issue of emerging businesses that aren't able to get a toehold for whatever reason, because they don't have the relationships, and the mentoring relationships, or they don't have the longstanding relationships, that just occur organically. Through community and social contacts. I mean, it's hard to really know. There are, some emerging businesses, some established businesses, and they're just not getting a piece of the pie for whatever reason. The findings, which we've removed, are derived from some findings of fact that the Department of Administration have officially filed, and are the outgrowth of a fairly intensive study that was undertaken by an objective third party that they contracted with. They looked at MnDOT and a couple of other agencies that dispense large amounts of money out into the private sector to carry out the activities of public services. The collaborative is working, and maybe Mr. Tittle, you can describe all the committees and the subgroups of the collaborative that's trying to address some of the areas that you touch on, the capacity and competency of these subcontractors, mm-hmm. Whether or not they exist or trying to exist. These are, to answer one specific question, this is really focused at subcontractors, those who would carry out smaller pieces of a larger contract under a prime contractor. So these are the smaller folks who are doing little pieces of a larger construction project.
Mr. Tuttle.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Perry, in reference to some of your earlier questions, the benefit of this program would be focused on the state projects. State projects in nature are a lot smaller. On the federal side of the house, a lot of these smaller businesses have no opportunity, I mean almost zero opportunity to actually get a toehold into the industry. So providing an opportunity for them to engage some of these smaller projects is clearly identified through this legislation. Secondly, through the collaborative, as I'd mentioned, the TGB group that I'm a member of, there's a number of stakeholders who are present who have applied for federal projects and who have applied for state projects, and they just cannot get a toehold either. We do have training programs that we incite through the collaborative, and we engage in that. And I actually came from one of them where we train folks how to estimate on projects, bid on projects, and do a number of things relative to developing and maintaining a business in this particular industry. And just educating the normal citizen who actually participates in this in the collaborative is also helpful, because a lot of folks assume that building a house or doing, you know, vertical construction is just the same as horizontal. It is a completely different world. So we want to educate everybody along the way, and it actually gives everyone an opportunity to build build on what they've got and what they're trying to develop as a business through this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this, and Senator Dibble, I know we had a discussion, I believe last year again, about DBEs holding up projects. Will we get into a situation like that in your mind, or should this help move along some of those issues that we talked about last year in transportation?
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Two ways to answer that question. One is, reflecting back on your earlier question, are we gonna be hiring subcontractors who just aren't up to the job, and really bog down a job because they don't do it very well, because they're not experienced or for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. That was been a issue that's been specifically identified. I've been made acutely aware of it, and taken various tours and sat with a number of the stakeholders to hear about those sorts of things, and I agree that that is unacceptable, and I think the collaborative, power of the collaborative, is the fact that everyone is sitting there from all sides identifying these issues, so that we don't go down that path, because that has been a problem in the past, where we just hire someone because they fit a certain mm-hmm. profile, and they're just not up to it.
Interesting.
And so some of the other elements of the collaborative, some of these other subgroups are addressing that, and doing a nice job. The other is, are we holding up the letting of contracts or slowing things down because prime contractors aren't conforming to the requirements? They're not slotting folks in sufficient numbers. I think the language of this bill gives the commissioner great discretion, and it also, the language of the bill says, there have to be folks, competent folks available, and it's a reasonable efforts towards finding those folks, but we're not going to be slowing things down because of this. If the folks aren't there, and it's shown to be so, they're just not there to be hired.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Dibble. I guess I have a couple of quick questions for you. I'm looking at just the bill summary here, and in Subdivision 2, it's speaking of economically disadvantaged areas. And I'm not seeing that in the legislation before us, and I was hoping that you could expand on that. And then after that, I do have one more comment and question.
Senator Dibble.
I need to find the language. Looking at the summary or looking at the language of the bill itself?
2.29 through 2.31.
2.31. So, Mr. Chair, that's a language that exists already in statute, and it's economically disadvantaged areas defined in Section 16C.16, Subdivision 7. I'll look to Council to help me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, could we have Council review that?
This is the Mr. Chair and members, this is the language that gives the commissioner himself or herself discretion to award the 4% of a 4% preference for specific construction work. This is outside of the prime contractor with vis-a-vis subcontractor goals. This is something that the commissioner himself can undertake in terms
Thank
of
you.
Awarding a percentage preference. But I don't know what 16C.16 okay. subdivision
Thank you, Senator is. Dibble. And to Senator Cruz's point, Ms. Berzofsky, if you could.
Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I'd like to point out that on 2.29, this gives the commissioner discretion to award up to 4%, whereas up on 2.11, it's a 6% preference. And so the targeted group business program basically is an up to 6%. So this is a special provision for economically disadvantaged areas where the commissioner can give up to 4% to small business. And economically disadvantaged is defined in 16C. And it can, if it meets one of three specific measures, the first one is the median income in the county for married couples is less than 70% of the state median income. The second is that it's a area designated as a labor surplus area by the U.S. Department of Labor. And the third is that the business is a certified rehabilitation facility or extended employment provider.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Berzofsky. I guess, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, my second comment and would be this. This bill touches very close to home for me in the fact that I had a constituent just this past year, a very entrepreneurial woman, very successful business, and she had operated under some of these small business set-asides. And one of the things that she approached me about was under these programs, what she has found is that she is competing against companies that will list a person, whether it be a qualifying person, as the head of a company, but yet it's really somebody else behind the scenes that's running these businesses. And she was really concerned, you know, that put her at a big disadvantage as far as the competition goes. And I found out just this past year that because of that, she had a flourishing company, 32 employees. She had to lay off 28 of those employees because of the economic circumstances and because of this competition. So I guess my question to you would be, you know, how do we resolve that issue, first of all? And secondly, you know, I guess a comment is I have some real serious concerns every time we get into these situations where we as a state government are attempting to what I would qualify as pick favorites in any case. I think we open the door for abuse like this, and it really concerns me. So I guess I would just like to you know, have you speak to that.
Sure.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Those are also excellent points and questions. So this issue of you know, putting up a shell person, there's an expression for it, I can't remember what it is exactly, has been a problem that we've seen in the paper recently with the Central Corridor, for example. One of the contractors, I think, was ruled ineligible because of that very ruse. And that's wrong, and it's fraud, and needs to be dealt with. And I believe we have language in statute in other places that deal with that, so that's why you probably don't see anything carried in this particular bill. And, you know, it's really a question of, you know, the administration of these contracts and the diligence and the oversight in the investigation and the follow-through. And to the extent that MnDOT or the Met Council is doing an insufficient job, we need to hold them to account for that, because it, you know, that has proven to be a problem in some cases, and so we need to address it. So I agree completely with you. But to your to your point, the businesswoman that you cite, had done well, but for this fraudulent circumstance that she ran into, and that's probably a good thing, and what this language proposes to do is to allow her to establish her business. Let's leave the fraud piece aside for 1 second. Establish, get the toehold, receive the preference for a time limited period, and then ideally, then they're moving on to stand on their own 2 feet, become self sufficient, and compete on an equal basis because they've got the infrastructure, the wherewithal, they've developed the relationships in the business community with the agency, et cetera, so that they don't necessarily need this sort of preference weighting system. And also, it asks that we examine very closely the way we did a couple years ago the need for something like this. So we do that analysis, and we also do the report back to the legislature. Like I said earlier to Senator Perry, this is a complicated issue, and I think what we try to accomplish is exactly what your goal is to not pick favorites. And for whatever reason, favorites are being picked now, and there are some people who are just being left aside. And it's a legacy of something that's happened in the past, and it probably stems from we know how the world kind of works. It works on relationships and social connections and mentoring and norms and that sorts of thing, and patterns are established, and it's an attempt in just a small way to maybe level the playing field just a little bit, so some other kinds of folks can get a toehold, get established, get up and running, but on a limited and fairly rational basis, not just kind of throwing open the doors and excluding other folks. I think it's a kind of a moderate way to proceed in addressing something that's been identified as an actual problem.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, I think those are valiant goals. I think those are things that as a society in general we need to strive for. And I think we also see with the difficult economic times as there's fewer resources to go around. Unfortunately, programs like this more often in that environment will be susceptible to fraud because there's less resources to go around. So people are looking for every option to kind of get that leg up. And that's an unfortunate thing, but I think it shines a light on a very particular problem. And I guess, just kind of one follow-up question, Mr. Chairman, is can you speak to the past success of these set-aside programs, and I'm truly interested, what are some of the results? We've had these for a while. Mm-hmm. Do we have measures out there to see if this is actually being effective, and what are those results?
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tittle, as a very close acquaintance with some vertical construction that's kind of a model for what we're trying to do here. Frankly, we have not been super successful in the transportation sector with some of this stuff. We haven't applied these sorts of things very well to state projects, and the federal requirements and regs have only been followed fairly loosely, and that's a subset of the sorts of transportation work that we do in the state. But we can talk about the convention center, the Twin Stadium, some other great models you want to.
Right.
Certainly,
Senator Cruz, to answer your question, what types of successes have we seen? MnDOT is required to report to the federal government annually about their increase in disadvantaged business enterprises and how we've actually performed. Over the past 3 years, they've done nothing, or MnDOT has done nothing but increase in their performance. It started out around 2.5%, and now we're sitting at about 8.7% as far as it relates to disadvantaged business enterprise performance. And that we expect to continue to increase as we've pushed a few resources in the Department of Transportation's Office of Civil Rights. For example, they brought on my position, the deputy director. I'm responsible for oversight, as Senator Dibble had mentioned. The increase in oversight, what are they doing? They brought me on.
For this program, we would bring on a few other specialists whose sole responsibility would be to, one, set goals on projects, two, monitor the projects for those types of fraudulent situations. Since I've been here, since I would say the beginning of September, I've sat through a number of hearings by the Department of Transportation addressing those same situations. And I'm proud to say that a number of those hearings have went in favor of the smaller business who recognize some of those things happening. And certain businesses were decertified as disadvantaged businesses and the like. So it's interesting that you bring those things up. And I can't speak for, you know, what happened 10 or 15 years ago, but here in fiscal year 2011, there's been some significant changes. Some of the resources that have been apprised to these companies are, as Senator Dibble mentioned, mentor protege programs, where they're matched up with some of the larger businesses who could help build them into something larger over the next few years. Another thing, working capital loan funds, where they're assisting them with applying for loans and actually achieving getting those loans so that they can bid competitively on jobs.
Senator Cruz, can we move on with the bill here, or do you have another quick comment?
Well, I did have a real quick follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. First, Mr. Till, thank you for your testimony. Senator, I appreciate you being here. My question is, and that's great, and I would be excited to see that information. Has there been any analysis done as our population here in Minnesota becomes more diverse, what effect that has on those numbers? Because I know, you know, especially in recent history, we have become a more diverse population. And as that population expands, obviously a greater portion, I would imagine, would by default be more successful. You would have a larger presence in the overall community. Has there been any analysis done on that?
Mr. Tittle.
Certainly. I cannot say that there has been any analysis done on that, not since I've been there. And I'd like to refer to anybody who does work at MnDOT who's been there for a minute to reference that statistic.
Oh, Mr. Tittle, is it something that you could research for us and provide to this committee in a future date?
I could research it and provide you some information as to if – whether or not we've done that,
sure,
that type of research in the past.
Sounds,
yes,
good. Senator Dibble, would it be would you be all right with laying this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would be delighted to make that motion.
All right. Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1126 be laid over as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. And without it,
oh, did you say as amended?
As amended, I did say. Seeing no further business to come in front of the committee, the Transportation Committee will stand in adjournment until February 14th, 2012 at 1 p.m.